respond or speak a little bit about the questions that John raised? Or do you want to do something else first?
Well, let's do a quick introduction, and then John can actually raise those questions
okay.
that we have
Very
on
good.
The recording. All right, so today is the 10th of June, 2014. This is the third interview with Paul Buell. We're actually here at the University Club. Paul and I are actually side by side for the first time in these sessions, and with us too is John Tortorici. So John, before we turned on the recorder, you had a couple of questions you wanted to make sure we asked, so why don't we start with those?
Okay. I was interested in how the New Left in Madison in the 60s conceived of its political engagement. Was it an attempt to build a viable political movement that engaged with other groups in the culture, labor? I know there were attempts. Was it naive and politically naive in particular, and more interested in a kind of psychological or emotional throwing up of anger and resentment at parents, at culture, at politics? I mean, was there any figure? And then, you know, I'm kind of, this is a leading question, but I was
quite a leading question.
And Mossy, and you know, who always claimed that he attempted to that he was very sympathetic towards the students, but he attempted to get them to think about a long-term political engagement that was viable, but that also understood all of those insights that he had developed in the course of his explorations of mm-hmm. politics and mm-hmm. symbolism and mm-hmm. you know, myth, and that came out of his own history from mm-hmm. the 30s and 40s, etc. So just an overview of mm-hmm. how the New Left conceived of itself as a political movement, and whether it did have any theoretical interest or engagement.
Well, I think the most important thing is to see how distinct two or more likely three generations were involved from the founding of Studies in the Left in 1959 on the campus of UW to the founding of Radical America in 1967, same campus, and then to the departure of Radical America from the campus in 1971, by which time, over a period of 4 years, things had changed very drastically again. Studies in the Left was formed by a group of intellectuals who were mostly graduate students, and in the beginning were a scattering of different sorts of intellectuals, but most of them were historians, and a few, like James O'Connor, who was a sociologist, regarded them as odd people out because mostly it was historians. The older ones among them, notably James Weinstein, who had the money, his father having been a grocery store entrepreneur of major means on Cuba, who as an old communist sort of cheerfully gave up those grocery stores, but still had quite a bit of money. And so James Weinstein had what no one else had around that studies group, which is money to publish a very respectable looking journal, more professional and respectable and journal looking than Radical America would be able to achieve on virtually no money. It was said in 1959 or 1960 that James Weinstein was unique among the editors of Studies in the Left because he lived so far from campus that he owned a car. Madison was a smaller place in those years, and to own a car was to be unusual and be off the campus. So Studies in the Left formed, and in its first issue it described, quote unquote, the radicalism of the disclosure. That is, they had most of them broken away from some section of the Communist Party or its youth movements. Weinstein had been a communist, and several other people had been in the Young Communist League on the campus of UW in the mid-1950s and had become disillusioned with the Hungarian Revolution and the Khrushchev revelations of 1956. But they had a background in the old left. They had heard that there was a new left, calling itself the new left, founded in Britain in 1956, led by the great historian E.P. Thompson and peace leader, and they wished to follow in its wake. Actually, even by 1957 or 58, there were new left clubs in four or five cities of the United States. And a magazine called The American Socialist, with its roots in Trotskyism, was seeking to encompass some new left and find some new point of departure that wasn't the discredited communists, wasn't the hopelessly sectarian communists, wasn't the fuddy-duddy socialists as far as they existed or any other existing thing, but what they wished to call a new left. Inspired by Britain, but hoping to find a new generation of radicals in the U.S. So they had detached themselves from anything that could be considered orthodox Marxism. They didn't believe in the grandeur of the proletariat seizing power in the immediate future. And in fact, the central ideas of Studies in the Left, of James Weinstein and others, were circling around the notion of the corporate state, how the New Deal that had seemed to most people in the old left, communists in particular, to be the best thing that America had ever come up with, was in fact a partner, a marriage partner with corporate America. And while it dispensed great deals of social welfare, it also locked itself into a corporate agenda. It sought to produce students ready to work in the corporations, as university presidents of that time proclaimed. And it had its precursive origins in Woodrow Wilson and the progressivism, which at the time of World War I linked social progress with the American empire and with the spread of American corporate power around the planet. So that Studies in the Left and among its notables on campus had been those who attended UW, Professor Warren Sussman, early 1950s, Joan Scott also was here, James Gilbert was also here, and several others. The managing editor was a woman whose name escapes me now, but wrote an essay in History in the New Left, and it was very important in the journal as it progressed. But at some point, around 1964, 1965, they mostly moved to New York City, and the journal moved to New York City, took on new editors, and sought a little more openly to embrace the social movement as it developed out of the civil rights movement and the new left. And various new editors, like Staunton Lind, challenged other editors to become more involved in the first stirrings of the anti-war movement and more involved with social movements like SDS. And other editors in its New York phase, like Eugene Genovese, bristled at this. And if you couldn't say that they were interested in Marxist theory as such, you could say they were already deeply steeped in academic life and believed in the rigors of producing history and in being socialist intellectuals whose first task was to produce scholarship and whose responsibility to organize things or to be involved with organizers was far less important. So there was a conflict within Studies in the Left over what would be more important, scholarship or engagement with activism. And by 1966, they came to a point of division and they couldn't maintain the publication anymore. So it folded. And so after that long introduction, Radical America was founded in part precisely because radical studies in the left had folded. It was consciously or unconsciously the successor to studies in the left. But it represented a new generation of graduate students, those who were 10 years younger, at least, than the studies in the left crowd. It represented people who had no background in the Communist Party or the Young Communist League or anything. We were too young, and we were never of that ilk. And if it's true that we also were historians, we were coming of age at a time when the social movements were growing very rapidly and the civil rights movement had led to the anti-war movement. And we were casting around, trying to provide young people in SDS in particular, since unlike studies in the left, Radical America considered itself part of SDS, an educational arm within SDS. We were trying to provide people a notion of the historical roots of what might become an American left. It wouldn't be very true to say that in the much smaller number of pages in Radical America that there was a lot of room for discussing Marxist philosophy. For instance, although by 1970 there would be special issues on philosophy, or academic debates involving sociology and anthropology and other things which might have appeared in studies in the left among those who were already young professors. In Radical America, there really weren't anybody who was yet a professor, and many of the editors, but also the readership of Radical America, were more inclined to be the fellow who ran the independent bookstore, independent and radical bookstore, near campus almost anywhere. They were people who bridged the division, or sought to bridge a division, between scholarly or, let's say, solid intellectual work on the one hand and political activism on the other. Studies in the left sort of willfully withdrew from the demands of activism because there wasn't much of it in 1959, and then found itself drawn back into its own collapse, you might say, whereas Radical America started with the idea that there would be a bridge between activism and theory, or activism and organized knowledge. I think theory still implied a higher realm of people sitting in a room discussing Adorno or something. And there certainly were people within the Radical America orbit who loved to discuss Adorno, but they didn't write much about it in Radical America. That would be the best way to put it. And there was exactly one person who was on the editorial or advisory editorial board of both publications. And that person was a very favorite student of George Mossy, that is Paul Brynäs. There weren't any other direct connections, although several other people who either edited issues or were editorial advisors included Stuart Ewan, for instance, David Gross, another person who could be called a Mossy student, though he was in German history. And
he's a Mossy PhD.
A Mossy PhD, right. And several other people wrote or edited or took part who had taken courses from George Mossy and regarded his contribution to their knowledge as, you know, very significant. I'm getting long-winded here, but I'm trying to come to the question of did the New Left have theory? The best answer for that is that the generation that came into the anti-war movement in 1965, you might say with me on the campus of University of Illinois, although I was a little older than most of my fellow undergraduates and had already considered myself a Marxist, whereas they had little background unless their family was from the old left, as it sometimes was in Jewish Chicago and Jewish New York. For the most part, the people who were joining the New Left 1965, 66, 67, 68 were around the age of 20 and had not had time in their life to accumulate anything that could be regarded in a serious or rigorous way as theory. All this stuff was pretty new to them. And events were happening very, very fast. And the other factor is that the New Left was so porous that it differed enormously from campus to campus and city to city. It had no fixed organization, and contrary to the myths about Students for a Democratic Society, on many campuses, SDS did not exist at all, or did not exist until 1968-69, just before it collapsed. SDS tended to fill in the holes that were left, where other organizations hadn't come, or in conservative or southern or religious campuses, it tended to come in late because there was a vacuum and there was no other student organizations that were playing that role, which was substantially simply calling for demonstrations against the war and then trying to organize them and provide slogans. Madison was very unusual because there was this history of intellectualism on campus, because it was an intellectualism that was based in history, contrasting, for instance, to Michigan, where almost everyone was in sociology, contrasted to Columbia, where there was a wide variety of disciplines, but also a sort of rage at being at the most elite university, except for Harvard, and themselves often from very wealthy backgrounds, and therefore literally angry at their parents' milieu sometimes. It would be difficult to find that in Madison. None of us came from wealthy parents. Paul Brindis being the exception, really, maybe Stuart Ewan also. So that Madison was steeped in intellectualism, and at the peak of events, or even before 1967, 68, 69, it wouldn't be at all unusual to find the underground newspaper edited by a history graduate student, Robert Gabriner, who dropped out of history, to have the Teaching Assistants Association, led, if not by the absolute leader, at least those around him, graduate students in history, Ann Gordon being a great example of someone like that, but there were others who were historians, to have Radical America full of historians, the Alternative University, which was very abundant for a couple of years. Some of its leading courses were by graduate students in history. And for all of us, and contrary to the slurs against the New Left, we were graduate students, we were teaching assistants, we took ideas seriously. Most of us eventually became academics, but we didn't see it as contrary to our activist roles. If the New Left had lasted even five more years, there would have been much more intellectual work, you can call it theoretical work, that seemed to have some kind of overall connection to the social crisis. But by 1970, except for the women's movement, the gay and lesbian movement, and other movements to come, it was almost all over. So that those who went on to teach and write books largely did so in a vacuum from mass social movements.
So they kind of merged with the academic milieu that their politics came out of, in a sense.
That generation
positions on faculty and foundations or whatever. Many kept their engagement in politics, but from a kind of a protected distance.
That was far, far truer for the Studies in the Left generation than for the Radical America generation. The Radical America generation didn't really have academic jobs until the end of the 1970s. So they still lived an extended life as graduate students. And they were involved in such things as the local working class history and education projects, which were part of the Radical History newsletter, the Radical History organization, and for some years these were kept going in a dozen cities. And they, well, let me go back to Radical America's departure from Madison, because this is a sort of important point here, and then I'll take questions after that, but I want to clarify it. I asked Mary Jo Buell about our departure from Madison, and she said, which took place in August 1971, and she said, well, of course, most of the people in our circle were industrializing. That would be a very great exaggeration. But it is true that when the New Left had reached its apex on campus and was palpably declining, certainly in Madison from that upshot of the Army Math Research Center bombing, there was a swift decline in various kinds of anticipations, movements, and so forth, which we didn't really observe how Paul Soglin was rising and there was a new liberal coalition and his election was 3 years ahead and so forth. That was pretty much unknown to us because we were part of a New Left entity who thought, naively, that since the U.S. was in the midst of the largest strike wave since 1946, a strike wave that contained more non-whites, more women, and more new kinds of places that had never struck before, like the post office workers, that this was the beginning of a working class movement that would take over where the campus movement had failed, or would help to precipitate a broad social movement that included radicalized young people, but also included people from other social classes.
And you had that upwelling that of African American, well, you could say it was in a way a revolt. Some people would say there was a revolutionary aspect to that, but that emerged at that same time.
That's true, and for Radical America, who published a special issue essentially on black labor, but also on the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, which for a moment seemed to offer an alternative to the black power, pick up the gun kind of rhetoric, and seemed to be more solidly based in ordinary working class life, non-white working class life, but it challenged the bureaucratization of unions, especially the United Auto Workers, and it also offered a way forward that had a connection with Marxist ideas. Because if the people around Radical America disdained any kind of return to 1930s communist kind of ideas or Trotskyist kind of ideas, we thought there was something very valuable in Marxism, a way of looking at social class that was important for us, partly because the high phase of the student movement was over. And Radical America then, myself, Mary Jo, and most people around it made a choice to move to cities that had a connection between university and blue-collar life. This was a great idea for 1971, which seemed to have been a terrible idea by 1974, partly for the reason that those factories closed in very large numbers. We're at the beginning of the Rust Bowl phenomenon, partly because the thought that there would be some kind of breakthrough was extremely naive, and partly because the energy of the New Left that remained alive was drained off into these crazy Maoist Marxist-Leninists who would prefer to fight each other than organize some kind of larger movement. But as Radical America tried to maintain the spirit of SDS, despite the Marxist-Leninists on one side and weathermen on the other, so there were groups of hundreds of people, numbering perhaps several thousand around the U.S., who had the same mission as we did, to set up camp somewhere between blue-collar and university settings and find a way forward. And there were national conferences, and Radical America might have been the journal or magazine that was sort of the collective expression of those ideas. But that really did fail by 1972 or 1973. And with it, I left Radical America geographically, and the group that took over and maintained it until the year 2000 was largely college teachers in blue-collar colleges in Boston and community-based activists like Nick Torkelson, who worked in these community groups that were struggling to improve life and hold on to deteriorating conditions.
Well, we could probably talk about this these few years for hours on end.
Indeed.
I assume you already spoke of what a fertile ground Madison was for a movement like this to evolve from. You had C. Wright Mills, you had Hans Gerth, you had all of these students that had worked with them that then went on to other universities, Domhoff. Then you had Harvey Goldberg, you had George, you had this such a rich intellectual milieu and a long history of radical politics here.
Yeah.
And it just, but to me, because I do remember something of that period, I came right after the real engaged years of the late 60s. I started in 69, 70, and by then the Maoists, the Stalinists, the Trotskyists were really had become the face of leftist movements on campus.
Quite right.
And for me, it was always a kind of romance, that period, and it's how it's remembered a lot by people. But that sense of what it was like to be so empowered, to feel that you could change the world, that you could create a better world, that you had all of this attention and power, and the excitement, you know, both the interpersonal excitement, but just a feel of what it was like to live in that period on campus.
I know I've said this in an earlier interview, but it really bears to me repeating, since it probably is the most evocative experience before the uprising in Madison in 2011, and resembles it in some ways. The month after the police riot at the Dow incident, the strike itself, so ardently supported, at least by liberal arts students, if not engineering students, the eagerness of those students to set up their own classes, to reach out to us graduate students for real knowledge, to come back after the strike and engage with their teaching assistants and sometimes their professors, their yearning to learn things, their hunger to learn things, because they felt as 19-year-olds in 1967 that not only could they change the world, but by God they had to, because they were subject to the draft. Their boyfriends or other relatives were subject to the draft. And it really was a matter of ending the war before something even more horrible happens. And I've just left aside the horrible things that were being done to the Vietnamese. And I think that the warmth of the connection between graduate students and undergraduates was often set off from the coldness between the professordom on the one hand and the graduate students and undergraduates on the other. It's often been said, and even George said it in later years, that the faculty was traumatized by the social movements on campus. But our view was different. We felt that we were traumatized by the war and troubled by our relationship with the professors, whereas from the professors' point of view, they were troubled by the war, but they were traumatized by the students. There's a vast difference between those two standpoints. And to be really uncharitable and leave aside Harvey Goldberg and George and others, you could say, because professors did not support the strike and in many ways were unsupportive and in many other ways accepted strikes and stopped teaching or declined to flunk students who didn't come to classes during those strikes because they were intimidated out of doing it. They and other professors in that era, very large numbers, felt personally terribly insulted when undergraduates would speak up or seek educational reforms. I mean, that one of the great ironies, this is not too much of a diversion, is Brown University, where Mary Jo Buell and I would teach for many years, was transformed from a dullish, very lower level New England, Ivy League school into a great, wonderful place because the administration accepted the idea of educational reform in the face of student protests on general issues. In Madison, the administration did not accept the idea of educational reform, and indeed, the teaching assistant strike of winter 1970-71 ended unhappily for undergraduates because the university accepted the union but declined to accept educational reform. So taking nothing away from the classroom ideas that George and Harvey and others put forward, the faculty as a whole was quite sympathetic toward administrators who were personally, quietly against, thought the war was a bad idea. Saying they were against the war would be a little too strong. Thought the war was an unwise idea, but remained faithful to the general vision of liberalism, which included the war, and were horrified by students who had become unruly. And who might for the younger a younger professor cause damage to their careers?
Well, and it, you have to throw in the contrast with Brown, because Brown's a private school, and UW was under intense pressure
from the state. Yes, and, that's true.
Fred Harrington, who actually was one of our greatest
a great figure, was fired.
And
yes.
So I think the people that came in.
Yes.
Were there for a reason, and
yes.
That is to tamp this all down.
Right.
No reform, and you're right, Scott. I agree completely.
I mean, as I'm writing this or drafting this memoir of Paul Soglin, I come again to the idea that if there had been administrators who were willing to risk their careers, there might never have been a Dow incident. But or if Fred Harvey Harrington hadn't been out of town for the day, to be really hypothetical. But the same thing happened across the country. There were university administrators who were put into a corner and told, if you don't bring in the police to break heads, then you'll never be elevated to be the president of Harvard or someplace. And almost invariably, they chose the police. They were thinking about their own interests, and they weren't thinking about the Vietnamese. That was, or they weren't even thinking about we and our undergraduate classes who were going to be drafted and sent into the war. Oh, they were concerned. Naturally, they were concerned. As liberal people, they were always concerned. But they weren't too concerned.
Well, after Fred was fired, they brought in the National Guard, as you know, and we had tanks rolling up and down University Avenue. And the intensity of the repression increased markedly, it seems to me. I remember when you had, you know, these police vans that had these screens on the front that would just charge into the students.
So it
got to be a kind of war of attrition in a way.
And this is the phases I discovered through the study of Paul Soglin and in discussion with the head of the firefighters, that the police, the Madison police, employed a considerable group of people who put on hippie clothes, threw bricks through windows, and accelerated the conflict as often as possible, because that way they got to have a lot of double time hours. And we thought of it as a war against the anti-war movement.
It devolved into what would now be considered these online games, it seems.
That's
to me.
Probably so.
It became a kind of cat and mouse.
That's probably so, but for us, as long as bombs were being dropped in Vietnam, it wasn't a game.
Yes. That's, I mean, for those people that were politically engaged.
And I also for the leaders of the Madison police, who were very right wing, the chief inspector was a bircher. It wasn't a game for them either. They saw this as the enemy, and they saw it as cracking down, as increasing their power within the city. and those Madison businessmen who wore the white shoes and played golf with each other on weekends, they too viewed Madison as being taken away from them by these campus radicals. And they certainly meant to put this down, and it wasn't a game for them either.
Right.
And first, they saw Paul Soglin as a very dangerous figure.
Yes.
George was trying to weave his way through this, and in a way, trying to rebuild a Democratic Party that had been terribly damaged by its support for the war. Or to put it this way, its unwillingness to support the idea the U.S. should bring the troops home now. The view of David Obey and other Wisconsin Democrats was the war was a terribly bad idea, but we shouldn't speak about it too often because that would damage LBJ. So we'll just sort of wait until a successful election of Democrats, and then the war will be ended in a way in which America will still have honor. For us, that was a completely unacceptable idea. Too many people were dying. So those are real divisions that could not be overcome by pleasant words or good feeling.
So you alluded to Army math, and we didn't get to talk about Army math last time. So I'm wondering, I mean, rarely do things have a simple answer, but I'm wondering what Army math had, what the effect of Army math was on the intellectual or the new left movement, as opposed to, you know, we talk about it tamping down to student protest in general, but what did it do to the intellectual protest?
Well, it's interesting that neither did it halt the Teaching Assistance Association from organizing successfully on campus, nor did it halt Paul Soglin's march and that of his allies from the city council to running the city. So contrary to the idea that it was so traumatic, that the left was so humiliated that it lost everything, that would be a really mistaken view of the situation in Madison. It was a terrible blow to the peace movement, coming at the back of an anti-war referendum, a community-wide anti-war referendum, which had actually passed against the war, to the horror, again, of conservatives, including many conservatives on campus, like the Russian professor, what's his name?
Petrovich,
who was horrified by the idea that the U.S. might lose the war in Vietnam. And there were others like him. So the Army math research bombing didn't end that, didn't end the well-organized movements, but it did shrink the milieu of activity and threw people off balance. And I suppose you'd say in Madison, it probably increased the desire to go to some other city to do some other kind of organizing, because we felt we were, to a certain degree, at a dead end, even though other things went forward. I mean, 1970 was probably the best year of Radical America for me, because we produced something like 8 or 9 really good issues against the background of Army Mass Research Center. We came to the conclusion, which may or may not be true, that because these fellows were talking loudly about their activities in the effort to bomb the Baraboo ammunition depot, talking loudly about it in bars, that any investigative organization would have been foolish not to have understood who they were and what they were doing well before they did it. And those of us who are conspiratorially minded, as I tend to be toward the assassination of Martin Luther King, sort of think that there may have been FBI agents one block behind in a car who knew exactly what these naive four characters were doing. And as in other places in the U.S. at the time, were very perfectly willing to see these things take place, because it would strengthen their hand enormously, as it did. Perhaps history isn't like that, and they didn't conspire, but the result was very much to strengthen the hands of those in power, conservatives in power. And doubtless to make it more difficult for all kinds of social movements in Madison for a couple of years anyway, and to allow later historians and journalists like a certain David, who was the son of the famous journalist here.
Marinus.
David Marinus, to reconstruct the 1960s in Madison as crazy radicals versus idealistic liberals, which is so far from being the truth that it's a travesty on intellectualism, on history, on Madison, on many other levels. But I would describe that as the accepted version.
The acceptable.
Acceptable and accepted version, because large numbers of people, especially those who hadn't been here, read David Marinus's They Marched in the Sunlight and clucked their tongues and said, yes, yes, the radicals were far too radical in those years. And the university administrators being against the war, how could anybody be thinking the war was a bad idea? How could anybody protest at the university when there were such good administrators?
It's also a kind of absolution for not doing anything.
Yes, because right, of course, they were so extreme you couldn't work with them and so on and so forth. Yeah, I think that's my viewpoint in all these years later.
John Rayton, if you have other questions, I wanted to ask about the graphic nature.
Oh yes, very good.
Radical America, good. Because it
connects with everything.
Yeah, this is an audio interview, but you have a Studies on the Left, sort of a very traditional looking journal.
Very good.
And then Radical America from a few years later.
Very good.
Not a traditional looking journal.
Indeed, I think there may have been one issue of Studies on the Left, more than one, that had interesting covers. Like this cover of an American Eagle to have an issue on imperialism, that sort of thing. But Radical America emerges in 1967 at the moment when the underground press suddenly, practically overnight, has hundreds of thousands of readers. And what is the underground press? It's newspapers started locally on a few hundred dollars, often not even with an office, because print runs of tabloids, thanks to technology, had become much, much cheaper. They hardly needed to sell advertising. All they needed to do was go out and get people, a few hundred people, to buy a copy at 25 cents each. The artists of underground newspapers, like the cartoonists, like the writers, and like the layout people, they were all learning these skills themselves. Not many of them had any training whatsoever. So that the appearance of underground newspapers and their vast popularity encouraged an explosion of art. And in some parts of the counterculture, that meant blacklight art and psychedelic art and so forth and so forth. But in my section, it meant finding artists to do cover drawings, working for a while with single sheet printer who printed one sheet at a time, and then we would collate the pages and then staple them and then send them out. And then later Radical America was printed by an anarchist printing cooperative in Detroit, and they too worked with the cover artist. But in our case, in Radical America, as long as there was a single sheet printer, the printer himself would decide on the coloring of the cover. It was as if every person in the publication of the magazine had a sort of creative contribution, and the printer was never seen as somebody who just happened to be printing. As a matter of fact, for the first several issues, the printer was also the leader of the Teaching Assistants Association, Henry Osloch, who had been also the chairman of SDS. You can see how small these circles really were. And it was printed in the back room of the newspaper Connections with a few spare feet. So as the editor, I looked to find a different artist, or find an artist for every issue. It turns out a number of these artists were, in fact, Nick Torkelson, as I now recall, or they just happened to be a photo that somebody else, someone had provided us and we did something arty with. Now, in the center of a 1967 issue was a series with one photo, and then in later issues, a series of photos, a whole photo section of Michael Lisi, who was among the outstanding graduate students at the time. Whose student was he? Was he Georgia's student or Harvey's? That I can't remember. But he was, a person who collected...
Harvey
student. Yeah. He was a photographer, very skilled photographer, who then, shortly thereafter, collected photos of dead and crazy people across Wisconsin. And that photo book was called... Wisconsin Death Trip. So he was a historian, too. He was thinking like an historian. And he went to Chicago during the 1968 demonstrations and gave us a bunch of photos from that, and we printed them on slick paper, and it didn't look very good at all. But it was our idea that a magazine should be, as even a crudely printed and underfunded magazine, should be as artistic as it could be. And another notion closely connected with that was that we took poetry seriously. Some poetry appeared in Studies in the Left to its benefit. Some poetry appeared in left-wing magazines. To my knowledge, that poetry was very often didactic. Workers, rise up, or students, start punching the police with your fists. We never had that view. We didn't think that the cover needed to be didactic. It was supposed to be interesting, and sometimes, like a hand against a wall, it was perfectly, totally non-didactic. It was even abstract. The cover of a 1969 issue printed by somebody called Just Folks Revolutionary Printing Commune, whoever they were, the cover photo was by Jim Hogan, who was a leading reporter for the Capital Times and a close friend of our poetry editor, Dave Wagner. Jim Hogan later became, with his wife, a famous detective story writer, a best-selling detective story writer. That's the oddball kind of crew that we pulled together. And another great example, this issue has some middle section printed separately from the rest of the issue, of Rabbits by T.L. Chris, a Cleveland poet who was best friends with the much beloved poet of the New Left from Cleveland, who committed suicide. Of D.A. Levy, committed suicide after leaving Madison and going back to Cleveland. But this four pages of his friend T.L. Chris's poets, the last being a poet R.I.P., poet rest in peace, was an homage to D.A. Levy, who we love so dearly and who could not be called didactic in any way whatsoever. So that's the kind of enriched milieu in which art and poetry were no more separated from us, we thought, than serious scholarship was separated from us, we thought, than going on the picket line for the Teaching Assistants Association was separated from us. It was all very, very rich. And as you say, it was a source for instant nostalgia since it disappeared so quickly. It went by so fast with our youth.
Maybe just to bring this forward in a sense, so your interest in graphic art didn't end with Radical America.
That's correct. And I left Radical America in 1973 because I was leaving Somerville, where it was published, and Cambridge Goddard Graduate School, where I taught 2 years. I then, 3 years later, founded a once-a-year magazine called Cultural Correspondence, which had very little luck in getting subscribers, less than Radical America. It just happened to lose less money every issue than Radical America since it was published so infrequently. That was okay, which lasted for 7 years. mostly in my hands, but it also had a lot of illustrations, comics, various kinds of experimental art, and finally, cultural correspondence was taken over by an art activism documentation group started in New York City, called PADD, Political Art Documentation and something else, set up as an art group around the ideas of anti-war, the next wars, and supporting the women's movement and abortion and gay rights and so forth and so forth. And finally, the magazine sort of had its last issue was a publication for PADD. So the art impulse was always there, even when it wasn't directly in my hands. And then by the 1990s, I developed the aspiration of publishing art books. Now, actually, in 1983, I had edited something called Labor's Joke Book, which was contained a lot of little tiny book, which contained a lot of labor cartoons, and a certain concern for what had been funny and useful in labor art in the U.S. But by 1999, I believe, I had begun publishing books like Images of American Radicalism, a great big album book of images of various kinds, the insurgent art of Mike Alowitz, a four-color book of a leading left-wing muralist, Mike Alowitz, and I was going on from there, sort of haphazardly. In fact, I published with my friends a couple of books in Rhode Island that were pictorial histories of Rhode Island labor, oral histories of Rhode Island working people with a whole lot of photos, and then finally in 1992, Vanishing Rhode Island, which was my photo book of places that no longer existed, of how the physical built environment, but also the natural environment was disappearing under the breakdown of the factories and the disappearance of the countryside. So I guess I had never been very far from pictorial ideas. Okay. But they did vary greatly from cartoons to photos to other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I was alive to the idea of finding some new means of expressing socially critical and radical ideas through images. We didn't touch back where we'd done earlier, I think in an earlier interview with the Radical American Comics in 1969. George, I was told, or he told me, that when an issue of Radical America arrived, he was a subscriber and it was a comic book, he thought perhaps he'd been given the wrong magazine, that he'd been given a subscription to a comic magazine or a comic book series. But, you know, I've thought about that since, and I think he was so enthusiastic about expressing so critical, socially critical, radical ideas in popular form mm-hmm. that he may very well have been tickled by it. Well, puzzled and tickled.
As you know, he was the
he kept it.
Historian of the origins of fascist
yes,
culture
right.
in popular culture.
Right.
And because his youth was so disrupted,
yeah.
he actually read all those.
Right.
He loved reading popular culture.
Right.
He always
right.
was.
Right.
He wasn't in the, like Marcuse,
yeah.
at the gymnasium. He
right.
was reading comic books.
That's right.
So
that's
he did.
Right.
He loved that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure he saw the potential.
And I think he and others, as they flipped through the pages of Connections, really the first underground newspaper, were as taken by the layout as they were by the rhetoric.
Coming from a media family.
Yes.
Too.
That, of course, that's right. The media,
yes.
the newspaper media was reinvented in front of his eyes.
Right.
It didn't last, this yes. one didn't last forever, and it wasn't capital intensive or corporate whatsoever, but it was a newspaper idea. And they used to say about Madison up until 1980 that it was one of the most newspaper-rich cities in the United States, because there were a bunch of alternative newspapers that disappeared, and some of them were so left-wing they competed against other left-wing newspapers. There was Connections and Madison Kaleidoscope and Takeover and King Street Trolley, and then others that are not even in memory because they appeared and disappeared. But it was a newsprint was cheap, and Madison was a place where people could actually get interested in anything new, and where there were plenty of handicraft and small companies that were happy enough to throw $50 down to have an ad in some little paper. And even now you see little ones, but they're almost all gone. But that would be the idea then. Sure.
Okay. So you and Mary Jo left, but then you came back in the early 70s. You left in 71 and came back a couple years later?
Here's what happened. When we were here, our favorite hangout, and for her, where she worked for 4 years, was the Historical Society. We loved it to pieces, and still do. And in order to complete our dissertations, and then for a little while longer, to turn our dissertations into monographs, we found it best to return to Madison for as many weeks of the summer as we could rent somebody's house cheap. And that turned out to be maybe 6 to 8 weeks every summer between 1973 and 1982. I don't think there would have been a summer we would have missed during that time. And we couldn't really grasp what was going on in city politics, except as Dave Wagner would explain it to us. We observed the newspaper strike, of course, and other kinds of things, but we were just here for the summer doing our research and taking long bicycle rides. But in that way, we never really detached from Madison except for that next 20 years, in which I visited intermittently to give speeches or conferences, and Mary Jo almost never did, until we stumbled across Madison en route from Santa Cruz, California to coming back to Providence in the summer of probably 05, and then realized that we needed to retire here and that our good friends would be here.
Was it that stark a realization that you were in 2005, you stop here and say?
Pretty much. Our original idea had been to retire to Santa Cruz. Mary Jo was already having heart problems, and by 1995 I wanted to get her out of the academic East for at least a year in a quiet surrounding. But from the moment we got to Madison, to Santa Cruz, you would see some Madison bumper stickers, as you see some Santa Cruz bumper stickers in Madison. And some people would say, well, this is sort of like Madison, except it's in California. Except for the weather, which is entirely different. The city was run by a left-center coalition, pro-labor, which sought to limit sprawl and have good public transportation and other kinds of progressive policies. But there really was a sort of back and forth, as there would have been between Madison and Eugene, or Madison and Burlington, or half a dozen other cities that are of the same ilk. As it turned out, University of California at Santa Cruz was intellectually not a very lively place. Everybody's surfing. Why would they read books? And a lot of the faculty drive back to Berkeley every night. Why wouldn't you? Even over America's most dangerous highway, they have to get back to Berkeley. But also the medical facilities are very, very poor, so that sort of was impossible for Mary Jo. And then again, it's never been easy to make as many friends as you can easily make in Madison. And then again, Mary Jo grew up on Lake Michigan, maybe 15, 20 miles south of the Wisconsin line. And so I suppose we're indelible Midwesterners. And that is probably as important as anything else, but it took quite a while to realize that.
So we're over, we're roughly an hour now.
Uh-huh.
I at least want to get on the record. I want you to talk about history of the New Left.
Good.
Since it is, imbued in
Indeed.
This town and this university.
Indeed.
So,
indeed. I guess I'd like to speak about history in the New Left and the biography of William Appleman Williams, perhaps mentioning comics in Wisconsin, because it's not a distant subject. Mm-hmm. And finally, it started in Wisconsin, the documentation of the uprising of 2011, almost all in one breath. Because these subjects don't seem very far apart to me at all. I wouldn't have thought so when History of the New Left appeared in 1990. It was part of my distant and receding past. But with these other books, it grew closer and closer to me, so that it looks as if it was almost a continuity, and as if in my mind I never left at all. So what would you like to ask about History of the New Left?
I think the question, and these actually I think are questions that John, through his pondering, so that the process primarily, so perhaps, you know, soliciting essays, was there politics?
Okay. This is a very interesting story and a very odd story. Somewhere in the later 1970s or early 1980s, Lee Baxendall got the idea of essays about Madison, mostly or largely about the later 1960s and the 1970s, perhaps inspired by the Soglin years, by the proliferation of cooperatives, by the struggle to make university radicalism, university-based radicalism, more relevant to the community, and a whole lot of other things. So Lee Baxendall started this project and even got an essay from Mossy. Dave Wagner told me that that essay was part of the package that was probably finished by the early 1980s. So Lee Baxendall could not complete this. Lee Baxendall had Parkinson's disease and was unable to go on with a number of other things in his life. And he turned the project over to Dave Wagner in hopes that Dave Wagner could complete it. But Dave Wagner, having suffered blacklisting for leading the newspaper strike, and then various other difficulties as he made a living as a newspaper man, handed it over to me somewhere around 1987. And I readily saw, trying to put this together as a book, that a whole lot was missing, and that it could be better reconstructed through taking the story back to roughly 1950 and following it through the lives of various intellectuals. Some of them actually got around to writing essays, but a striking number of them were asked by me to write essays and couldn't get it together. So this was the era in which I had founded the Oral History of the American Left, had a couple of years of funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and was interviewing a whole lot of people, mostly over the age of 80. But I was traveling, and therefore, by the middle 1980s, doing things like going to New York and going to Washington, D.C., and interviewing Saul Landau in his office at the Institute for Policy Studies, going to New York and interviewing Herbert Gutman, going to, actually Herbert Gutman was visiting Providence when I interviewed him, going to New Jersey and interviewing Warren Sussman, and so forth and so forth. Half the people wrote, and the other half, or maybe a third, actually were interviewed by me, and then I sent them a rough transcript, and we worked from there to make those rough transcripts into respectable essays. And at the end of the process, I stuck in a couple of appendices that I had come across in archives or asked someone to send me when I heard that they existed. One was something that Warren Sussman had written about the Smoking Room School of History, that room in the Historical Society next to the door across from the Memorial Union, where everybody had met and talked seriously about history in 1951 and smoked cigarettes furiously, which was quite nice. And the second one was a document I must have gotten from Lee Baxendall, which was a bit of the play put on by the anti-military wall of 1959, and written in part by Marshall Brickman, who of course worked on Annie Hall with Woody Allen. So those were delightful appendices. But much of the rest of it was a sort of push and pull operation, where I would find people who I urgently wanted to contribute. There was nothing by them. And I nagged them into writing something. And I'm very glad that I did, because it represents, you know, a little clip of memory. I don't know whether Paul Brynäs wrote the Mossy Milieu for me, or he wrote it earlier for Lee Baxendall, just as an example. But these stories and recollections, even some of them that were a little bit sour, were quite good in bringing back a story and sort of filling out what otherwise would be absolutely unknown, and which effectively, though I didn't know it then, launched me on the biography of Williams about 4 years later.
So did you ask Harvey to write anything?
I think he had died. As we were working on it, he had died.
Okay.
So there was a piece by Ron... Ron McCrae.
Right.
On him. That's right.
Yeah, 1990 out. Harvey died in 87.
Yeah.
So what about... is Joan Scott in here?
She was, you know, so high up in the academic world that something like this didn't and wouldn't have interested her.
Well, it's an amazing group of people that you were able
it's
to...
It's eclectically, you know, a lot. Some of it is based on people I just happen to know personally. Mm-hmm. And one could say, why not, why X and not Y? And I might not be able to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, contributing this earned you nothing in the academic world, to say you speak of, nothing in a financial way. So it was almost like an old friend's get together, and some of them, or at least one of them, Warren Sussman would never have permitted this interview to be published if he was still alive. Because this little cat, there's nothing negative in there, but a little bit too much insight into his personal life than he was familiar with, he was comfortable with, being a very private person, or because he didn't accomplish the great things that he hoped he would accomplish. And even Herbert Gutman, they probably might have wanted to present themselves differently, but never gotten around doing it. That's a possibility. And so it's possible that in some of these cases of people who died recently, I sort of got their story more than they had ever gotten around telling, or were likely to get around to telling if they'd lived another 10 years. Both of those guys died at age 58. So they died young. And their stories weren't told. Now, what I'd like to add is that as I began to work on the biography of Williams, who was dying just as I was beginning to write, I came to see Gerd Lerner to talk to her about Williams. She was his successor as president of the Organization of American Historians. And her memories weren't that great. She went to visit him. He was deeper in the throes of alcoholism than he'd been before. But he'd also tried to do these valuable things within the OAH, help to get young people to get jobs and bring more women to the fore and other kinds of benevolent things that he couldn't really carry through on, but Gerd Lerner did carry through on. And as I came to meet her, this would be in the early 1990s, she also pressed upon me my obligation as an oral historian to do some serious work with the Hollywood blacklistees, which her husband, her late husband, had been. Mm-hmm. And that probably was my launching point for another phase of the history I was never trained in Madison, because there wasn't a course in oral history. But somehow I think of it as in the milieu of Madison, historians and graduate students in history, what were you trying to do? You were trying to document everything. You were very serious about documenting everything. And you didn't believe in being stuck with one form of scholarship when there were a variety of forms of scholarship. And even if we didn't tap into the oral history projects, Civil Rights Oral History Project at the Historical Society, which is so incredibly important, it planted the seed of becoming an oral historian, mm-hmm. I'm quite sure. Well, where else would I have thought of founding the Oral History of the American Left in 1976, if I hadn't thought of it in Madison?
Well, you have in history someone like Heseltine, who always taught that course that engaged students in primary research, where it was basically based on biography, but also interviewing people. So there was that tradition.
Very much so. And Williams had his graduate students, including me. I wasn't his graduate student. I was a graduate student. His assignment to us, beyond the normal assignments to undergraduates, was to find documents and then write about the documents. And there was a graduate student named Steve Scheinberg, who was famous for taking undergraduates into the Historical Society archives and having them look at, 1976 to 1986, this was nothing special. But in 1961, it was something very special, something that historians didn't do with students. So that's absolutely true. The sense that things could be documented, and they might be documented in ways that most historians, as we always like to say, those historians from the Northeast, the Schlesinger generation who hated the Beardians so much, would never disdain to do because they were interested in the people in power. But we felt an obligation to do, and I have to add a footnote, and that is after the generation of Heseltine and Merrill Jensen and Merle Curdy and several others I could name, the American historians, the U.S. historians, as we came in to teach, were a new generation who mostly wanted to get jobs at other universities and looked upon Madison as a way station, and hopefully they'd get to the Ivy League, and they were really fortunate. They were not steeped in Wisconsin history as a rule. We didn't feel the kind of awe towards them that we felt toward Williams and memories of Heseltine and Merrill Jensen and Merle Curdy on the one hand, or Goldberg and Mossie on the other. There was a mutual non-admiration. They weren't so fond of us either. It may be that we U.S. historian graduate students, but all history graduate students, there were hundreds of us. We clung together. We had our own study classes. We had our own intellectual sessions. And so we did not need professors. And because our U.S. history professors, William O'Neill is a good example, since he was a perfectly affable fellow, and taught a course on radicalism with a huge enrollment that Mary Jo and I were teaching assistants for. They did not awe us or impress us terribly. We were okay with them and they were okay with us, but it was an uneasy relationship.
And they were doing, it was almost kind of a reversion to a very traditional
history. That's true. That's absolutely true. They were not in the Wisconsin School,
right,
which is the irony. The Wisconsin School had to leap over a generation to come back to something similar. Now, you could also say, and it would be very true, that the generation of studies in the left, most of them wanted to study the mechanisms of power. And unlike Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s group, they didn't admire the people in power. They quite disliked the people in power. But they thought of understanding history through the documents of the powerful, revealing the machinations of the powerful. Whereas, intuitively, instead of working it out intellectually, myself and my milieu wished to study not just the underclass, but all the things that hadn't been studied. After all, Mary Jo and two fellow graduate students went into the basement of the Historical Society, but also the basement of the Memorial Library and the Cutter Collection, and went through every book that had been written on the history of American women. There weren't that many of them, but they went through every single one of them and produced this article, which became a pamphlet for women's history for several years until a real women's history book appeared. So we weren't the only ones who were, myself and my male friends weren't the only ones who were discovering. We were part of a generation that was urgent about discovering. What Jesse Lemish, a difficult person, called history from the bottom up. But there was a value to the phrase. And was inspired by E.P. Thompson in Britain, too.
But history of power relations.
But for the studies in the left, it would have seen power relations from above. Mm-hmm. And for us, I wouldn't quite say power relations, because we were also inspired by Herbert Gutmann, who was, like Thompson, trying to gauge the ordinary daily lives of working people in the past, or minorities in the past, who didn't have the power to challenge, didn't create a socialist revolution or even join socialist parties, but nevertheless had a life that was worth recording. And up to that time, was very largely ignored.
John, do you have anything else you want? We're at about an hour and 50, well, hour and a half since we walked in here.
Uh-huh.
I want to make sure
you probably don't want to keep Paul much longer, but...
No, that's fine.
The only aspect, I don't know if you discussed the whole question of gender relations in the new left and this kind of romance.
That'd be good.
Yeah. No, we didn't. So,
that so that's
good.
Very good to take
up.
One of the striking things about that period, 1967 to 71, is that in 1967, you would have never seen on campus two males holding hands and looking romantically at each other, or two females. By the time we left campus, it wasn't an uncommon sight. That marks a very big change.
Well, you say it's still a bit uncommon.
It wasn't uncommon. It wasn't common.
Yes.
But you'd see it.
You would see it.
You would see it,
yeah,
and
right.
It wasn't a cause for outrage and right. So forth. Now, I remember in 1970, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Cambodia and the huge uprising, seeing male and female couples, and part of the populace outside of Madison or police presence, whatever, there would sometimes be jeers, but the jeers mostly didn't come from students. They may have come from engineering students, but even people who were surprised by it probably gave pause instead of shouted. Because it now was a sort of tolerated, if not approved, et cetera, et cetera.
But what about the relationship between men and women?
This is a deeper and more complex subject. I was reviewing a book of short stories by Marge Piercy, the famous poet, who'd been in Chicago before she moved to Boston and the Cape, and a well-known novelist. And in this collection of short stories, some of them from the 1960s, the most marked thing for me was the lack of sympathy that she had for women who were weak or male-centered, or especially who were just weak in character and didn't stand up to men. So that for graduate students, women were a minority, and it was very frequent for them to drop out of school. Drop out of graduate school because professors were not so friendly to them. Not bitterly hostile, but more likely to discourage than encourage. And when I received a teaching assistantship, and Mary Jo was eligible for a teaching assistantship, some professor, it might have been William O'Neill or it might have been someone else, said, well, only one to a family. And then he or someone else said, well, of course, Paul will be the one who gets the job. And I think the assumption then either was that the wife who was in graduate school would have children and not pursue a career, or perhaps she would teach at a junior college or something like, little did we know. And that was the accepted thing. And to a degree, it was also true in the anti-war movement that the minority of forceful speakers were women, And those forceful speakers tended to be women who were tough as nails, like Ann Gordon, who chain-smoked camels, you know, and took shit from no one. But it was hard for someone like Ann Gordon, a militant feminist, to be close to women who were much more passive or male-oriented or something like that.
And what about the way men treated women in the movement? Because there is always that kind of pull towards the romantic activist,
right.
Male, you know,
indeed.
Che Guevara.
Indeed,
kind of
indeed. In all of the social movements, that certainly was there. The men would be the speakers and traveling from town to town and girl to girl and so forth and so forth. I think on this campus, I saw the SDS slogan, "Girls say yes to boys who say no," speaking of the war. And there has to be some truth in that truism, because the young men were in a very, very difficult situation, as the women weren't in that respect. But I think it would be true to say in Madison, and true from 1960 on, that that exceptional women were less exceptional here than in other major campuses. They had a hard time. They often had to be tough and not particularly kindly toward, didn't have to be, but they were often not particularly kindly disposed towards women who weren't tough. But Joan Scott would be in that generation of women who found some professor who would treat them in an egalitarian way. But even George, our dear friend, after some lecture, Liz Ewan recalls, he had graded her paper, and he said, "This is very good for a girl." And Liz Ewan said, "No, it's very good for any student." So so much was the practice of gender expectations for males different from gender expectations for females, from intellectual work in the classroom to future careers, that it was very hard even for sympathetic and gay professors to divest themselves from this kind of general attitude. And everybody sort of felt about Harvey Goldberg, that he was very sweet in his male graduate students and undergraduate males because he was romantically inclined towards them. And I think that generalization wouldn't be entirely false.
All right.
Have we exhausted every possible subject?
We could go on, I'm sure, for quite some time, but I think at least for today we've exhausted every possible topic.
Maybe we'll come back to it again.
Who knows?
Thank you very much for your time.
I'm happy to.